Talk given Saturday, 5th May, 1973. You know how it is said that after the night of the Enlightenment, the Buddha spent many, many days under different trees, as they are called, experiencing the bliss of enlightenment and remaining in the state of complete samadhi, the ultimate meditative condition, which is the state of total communion. He first sits under what is called the Ajapala tree. And Ajapala is usually translated as the goat herd's banyan tree. Aja means a goat. Pala means he who tends. Aja also means the unborn. And I always look at it in this way only. He sat at the foot of the tree of the unborn, the tree of life in its supreme sense, of eternal life. And at the end of 7 days, he said these words: the Brahman, whose nature is mindful, whose nature is unsinful, not harsh, unstained, self-restrained, who has mastered knowledge and fully traversed the Brahma path. The Brahma path means the path of the holy life. He, rightly, a Brahman, ought to announce the Brahma word, the word of truth. He, who has no self-obtrusiveness in the world. And I want you to notice this statement: who has mastered knowledge. Dr. Horner translates it as master of the Vedas, and that far and away is a proper translation. Master of the Vedas. The original word is Vedantagu. He who has come to the end of the Vedas. Anta means end. Vedanta is the end of the Veda. See, he who has gone to the end of the Vedas. He, rightly a Brahman, may speak the prophetic word, the word of scripture, the word of truth. And remember that the word Brahman, which we understand ordinarily as referring to a man belonging to a particular caste, is not the original meaning of the word Brahman. The original meaning of the word Brahman, as you find in the Vajrasuchi Upanishad, is he who has become one with Brahman. And the Upanishad says unequivocally, whatsoever caste he may belong to by birth, the man who has realized the ultimate reality, has become the perfected Holy One, one with Brahman, he rightly is called a Brahman. And it is very important to notice how often the Buddha uses this word Brahman. Particularly remember how the last canto of the Dhammapada is devoted entirely to the Brahman. Now, it is one of the noticeable features in the Buddha's teaching that he more or less, to all intents and purposes, confines himself to the training in morality, in samadhi, concentration as it is usually called, meditation if you like the word, and in wisdom, the release of unerring insight into truth, into reality. He does not tell you in detail, or at least it is not published in any of the Buddhist texts, he does not tell you in detail what could be the meaning of the word master of the Vedas, gone to the end of the Vedas. What was all this Vedic knowledge about? He confines himself, because he was extremely practical-minded, to that part of religious teaching which enables the person to become free of all the obstructions that stand between himself and the fulfillment of his divine destiny. There are certain discourses which give a clue to the fact that there was so much other than what is in the recorded scriptures. For instance, in one of the discourses, he tells his disciple Udayin, "And Udayin, a course has been laid down by me, by which disciples of mine attain this, that, and the other." And he repeats that several times with regard to several different types of attainments. But nowhere in the written records is there any description of these particular disciplines. Nowhere. Again, when talking about the kind of training he sets before his disciples, he says that when this has been realized by you, you mustn't stop. That is not the end. There is something more. And then when that has been realized, oh no, don't you stop there. There is something more. And it goes on and on and on like that. In discourses of this type, they are generally confined to the moral development, to the development in the power of attentiveness and the release of insight. But all the other aspects which do bear upon knowledge, vidya, spiritual wisdom, he gives you no details. But a phrase like that, gone to the end of the Vedas, would give us an insight of some of the things that were included in all this Vedic knowledge. Let us look at the Chandogya Upanishad, at that famous conversation between Narada and Sanat Kumara. I've often quoted this, but only the first verse, in relation to the first verse, where Narada wants to learn about Brahman from Sanat Kumara. And Sanat Kumara says, "Tell me what you already know, and then I'll tell you further." And he gives this list of what he already knows. I'll read you the English translation. And this is by Radhakrishnan. And I mention Radhakrishnan not because he is Radhakrishnan, but because he is a very distinguished Indian scholar. And Indian scholars also, just like Western scholars, follow more or less this sort of phraseology. It's only one verse I'm going to read to you. Narada tells Sanat Kumara, "Venerable sir, I know all the four Vedas, the epic, and the ancient lore as the fifth Veda. I know the Veda of the Vedas," then within brackets as an explanation, that is grammar. "I know about the propitiation of the fathers, the science of numbers," and within brackets they put mathematics, "the science of portents, the science of time, chronology." Some have thought that this might be even history. "I know logic, ethics and politics, the science of the gods, the science of sacred knowledge, the science of elemental spirits, the science of weapons, astronomy, the science of serpents, and the fine arts. This, venerable sir, I know." Now, let us look, examine the actual Sanskrit words which are translated in this manner. Up to a point, the translation stands. But up to a much greater degree, the translation is misleading. These translations are made by us, living in our age, conditioned in our way, and therefore words like mathematics, logic, polity, and all the rest of it have their own specific meanings, which I would like to suggest do not apply in this old context. This is part of the old esoteric knowledge. Now, take the word, the four Vedas, that's all right. The Vedas as they stand, the Rig Veda, the Yajur, the Sama, and the Atharva Vedas as they stand. I know the four Vedas. He knows all the hymns were, and their meanings, and how they lay at the base of the great Vedic ritual ceremonial. He knows all about that, right. Now take this one, Pitriyam, the word which is translated as propitiation of the fathers. Or if you like, the rites in honor of the ancestors and the progenitors. Now when we read that, we think in terms of the little ceremonies that were performed to propitiate the spirits of the fathers, of our own biological ancestors. The Romans had that sort of thing. The Chinese had it and still have it. Ancestor worship is a thing which is well known to anthropologists who dismiss all that as the remnants of a primitive, backward people. Who are these progenitors? Who are these ancestors? There's an enormous list of names in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. But I would ask you to consider Genesis, because probably you will be better acquainted with that. You know how in chapter 5, for instance, you get the line starting from Adam, Seth, going up to Enoch, who is number 7, going up to Noah, who is number 10, or is he number 11 in the list, and so forth. These are not historical personages. They are archetypal representations of the stages through which humanity went, from its beginning with its primordial condition. This is what is meant by the ancestors and the progenitors in its most concrete sense. There is a deeper sense. These progenitors, these ancestors, represent the different stages which came into being in the process of the evolution of man as the cosmic energies interplayed with each other. These are the workings of transcendence. Don't ask me what books to read in order to find this. I have never come across any book which told me this. But this is the real meaning of the progenitors. They are archetypal representations of the stages through which man has gone. There are similarly archetypal representations to mark the different stages of cosmic evolution, the universe as we see it and know it, and also the whole of the universe which we can't see and which we don't know about yet. And these rites in honor of the ancestors and progenitors was the way in which the holy ones of those days expressed their reverence, their homage, their understanding of the play of these transcendent forces which brought us as we are now into being. See, this is something which we must really appreciate and understand. It is, so to say, the story of our spiritual umbilical cord connects us through this wonderful evolutionary process in time to the ever-present, timeless, eternal reality, which ever was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be. It's an umbilical cord of consciousness, if you like, from you yourself now as you are, from I myself now as I am, to that ultimate reality. Not only backwards in time, but eternally present in the now also. We are all related in that way to it. This is our great spiritual unity, our transcendent reality. You can't conceive of it. Don't try to make a picture, because we'll just be indulging in a foolish game if we try to make mental pictures of it. Don't let the imagination work here. Let the wheel of imagination be stilled. And in the stillness and silence, that which I do not know and should not try to know in the ordinary sense will take place and bear fruit in a harmless and totally beneficent way in daily life and consciousness. So you see, this puts a completely different complexion upon what is somewhat contemptuously described as ancestral worship. This is Pithriam. The next word, Rashim, which is translated as the science of numbers, and in brackets, mathematics. Mathematics in those days was 2 and 2 make 4. Forget all that, as far as the science of numbers is concerned. Narada learnt that at school. He did not need to go to the perfected Holy One in order to be enlightened in such respects. What is this science of numbers? Here, I believe, I won't swear to this, but I believe that the Kabbalah is more developed, has a more developed system, presentation, than the original Veda. The letters of the Hebrew alphabet are all associated with numbers. 1 to 9, then multiples of 1 to 9 by 10, that is 10, 20, 30 to 90, and then multiplied by 100, 100 to 900. That covers all the letters of the Hebrew alphabet, the 22 letters, plus the other 5, which are known as the final form in which 5 of the letters are written. Now, each of these letters in the Hebrew alphabet, far more so than the Sanskrit alphabet, are proper names. You take the letters as such. Aleph, Beit, Gimel, Dalet, or letters like Samek, Lamed, and so forth. You see? They are obviously complete words in themselves, and when they are written out in full, they are not just A, B, C, D sort of letters, but they are names composed of the letters of the alphabet. So you see, each single letter becomes a very complex thing. Now, every letter and each number was intimately associated with profound metaphysical concepts, metaphysical realities, not merely spun out by intellectual activity, but known through total experience in consciousness, in mind, and in body. This is something which the whole world has quite forgotten. Don't know about these things. This is all really part of that ancient esoteric wisdom. Now, these, I've used the term metaphysical concepts purely for convenience. Regard these metaphysical concepts not merely as so many thoughts composed of words in the brain, but as actual functioning energies, powers, forces. Now, these are creative energies. The word God is fundamentally associated with creation. God, the creator of everything. Now do you understand why the scripture is called the Word of God? The Hindus claim that Brahma, God the Father, was himself the author of the Vedas. Well, it's perfectly obvious that he didn't take a pen and ink and paper and write out the Vedas for anybody's delectation, his own included. It is power in operation, which is represented pictorially as that which is written. This is why the secret of Genesis has never yet been completely unraveled. There are things which defeat us when we try to understand Genesis. And it's the same with the Veda. There are things which defeat us all along the line. Defeat the intellect. Now this really is the meaning, this is what is implied in the term Rashin as the science of numbers. The play of cosmic energies and how they worked and perpetually, everlastingly work. Throughout the universe as the one total reality, throughout the universe as that one total reality manifested in terms of multitudinous particulars. It's a tremendous thing. If you take, for example, the first word of Genesis in Hebrew, Beresh, Bereshit, it's made up of so many letters, Beit, Resh, Yod, or how is it correctly pronounced? Hod. Hod, you see. Shein and Tav. The word itself has its ordinary colloquial meaning. But now you take the different letters and take their own individual numbers assigned to them, work out their meanings, and then, since each letter is a name in itself, work out those meanings, and you will get the whole universe evolving out of the one. The many coming out of the one. Out of the first word only. You see in what sort of a realm we are. Why in the supreme realms of religion, in the supreme depths, we associate awe, majesty. We veil our face, we shut our eyes before that supreme truth, that supreme reality. What is the significance of it? That we do not let the senses with their limited capacities intrude upon that indescribable immensity. When one is really aware of these things and wakes up to them, one is in the supremely religious state. The holy ones of the Vedas, of the Upanishads, they knew all about this. There are so many hints throughout the Upanishads. Provided you yourself have become so purified that at last the mind, empty, pure, receptive, can light up from within itself and you know what the truth is. The knowing which is indescribable and incommunicable. I am saying these things because they may just produce a vibration, stimulate, and something worthwhile may happen. That's all. Not as a fixation of truth or reality. That is why I always say, forget the words, forget the thoughts, just get the impulse, let it fructify, and let the life process go on and on and on. It's very difficult, but there we are. Now let us take the word Daivam, which is translated as the science of portents or augury. And I have put it put down this as the translation, the way to look at it. It is the science of the nature and function of devas. You know, the word deva has been translated as God. The devas are the gods, we say quite loosely, simply because of the root of the word deva, which is div, which means to shine, and deva also means to give. You know how in all the religions we talk of God the giver of all good things and so forth and so forth. You see? So div means that. And that a deva is God in that sense, the giver, the one who bestows, the one who shines, who is, in other words, enlightened. And the first and concrete meaning of devas is those who are great ones in the worldly sense, in the world, kings and queens and they are people with power and who are important, and those who are the artists, the scientists, the etc., etc., the shining ones. They shine out in the world, don't they? Nowadays, too many tycoons also shine out in the world. But we'll forget them for the moment. So now, devas means that. And it's the science of the nature and function of the devas. But now let us look at the deeper aspect of devas. The Buddha is constantly talking of devas. He takes the devas of the Rig Veda, Indra and Prajapati particularly. He mentions them again and again. See? Now, we have considered this matter before, twice at least during the years. When one is in the deep states of consciousness, especially from the time when one enters into and abides in the plane of infinite akasha, as in Hindu terms, Brahmanical Upanishadic terms, it is in what is called sushupti. You see, which is compared with, not to be identified with, but compared with dreamless slumber. See? In that state, everything that belongs to the disturbance and activity of the sense world, sense impressions, and the discursive mind has become perfectly pacified and calm. And therefore, one is a receiving set, so to say, for the energies which belong to that transcendent state, which in India we called akasha. Transcendent energies. Now, we have just used the word akasha. There is no description of these energies because you cannot give a scientific description of them. Quite impossible. Analytical description. That energy functions in and through us and changes us and our innermost state of consciousness, our mode of awareness of existence, not to be thought of, not to be understood as states of mind, moods or an exalted state of mind or an inspired state, not just that, it's something much deeper now, the mode of awareness of existence. when you come back to ordinary sense mind activity again, if you remain quiet and still for a long time, and it must be for a long time, consider the significance of the holy ones. When they return from the states of the supreme samadhi, they stay quiet for days together. This statement about the Buddha, for instance. He spent so many weeks in perfect quietness on returning from enlightenment, performing different kinds of meditation, as they are called. You see? If you stay in that state of quietness, then the impress of this transcendent energy slowly gives rise to thought forms and verbal formulations by the brain. Now, the verbal formulations by the brain are the prophetic speech, the word of God, which comes out. Now, amongst these verbal formulations are formulations which suggest the different main ways in which this transcendent energy functions in us. When we, for example, in our own day and age, when we talk of transcendent love or wisdom or goodness or beauty or truth or something like that, we are trying to name the different forms in which that one and only transcendent energy functions according to the context in which it is functioning. Therefore, according to the context, it functions thus, and we say this is divine love or transcendent love. In that context, a different shape, a different pattern of expression comes out, and we say this is insight, wisdom, etc., etc. You get it? These are the devas in the supreme sense of the term, the gods, the great gods. You look at it this way, you see, you have to meditate deeply on it. My own interest has been half a century and more with this. Meditate deeply on this and you will understand what on earth is the meaning of the great gods of the Rig Veda, the Greek pantheon, the Scandinavian pantheon, or any of the great pantheons. These are names which represent transcendent energy, creative energy at work. Or if you like to use a theistic expression, the ways in which God works or providence works or whatever it is. But these are realities within the consciousness of you, a human being. Provided you, the human being, I, the human being, am not so preoccupied with my little mud pie in this world, that I'm just totally blind, deaf, dumb where the eternal reality is concerned. And you will find, if you look deeply enough, that all these great pantheons, they correspond beautifully. Zeus of the Greeks is Deus in the Rig Veda, and he is also related to Indra, because Zeus is the thunderer, Indra is the thunderer. Yahweh is also the thunderer, and so forth. They all have their relationships. You get the god of wisdom, and in the Greek pantheon we have the goddess of wisdom, and so forth. We have, in terms of the names of the archangels and angels, the representations of different ways in which the one transcendent energy functions. The great names, Michael, Michael, as we say ordinarily, Raphael, Uriel, Samael, and Gabriel, and the whole lot of them, and they all have their significances and meanings. And they are all related to the actual physical universe as we experience it and know it. This was ancient Vedic knowledge, ancient religious knowledge. What would happen in one of our modern schools if we tried to teach this sort of thing? I don't mean children's schools, in universities. So, Devam was that. Then we'll take another word, Vako Vakyam, which is translated as logic. Literally, the word of the word. I like to equate it with the original Veda or the original Kabbalah, which was transmitted orally. The word of the word. Just as in the Upanishads, you find this wonderful expression with regard to the Atma, ultimate reality, talking of it as Satyasya Satyam. Satyam, the truth, Satyasya of truth. The real of the real, very God of very God, we have the Christian phrase. The absolute essence. Perhaps in Buddhist terms, Adi Buddha. You see? And that's the Vako Vakyam, the essence of the whole thing, the ultimate real, the wordless word, so to say. The word which is not merely a representation of another something which we name the reality, but which is reality itself. See, supposing I use these phrases. The reality stands before you, a light full of form and beauty and marvel, in itself empty. Emptiness is form, form is emptiness. But it stands before you as light. It stands before you as sound. It stands before you as smell and taste and touch and everything. There are so many hints in the Upanishads about this. Scholars have never touched these matters. They have never written about it or... Well, I suppose they can't. This is the difficulty. Now, take the word ekayanam, which is translated as, and this is a correct literal translation, the one and only way to do things. But you see, they have translated it as ethics and politics. Do you think that the holy ones were interested in political philosophies or economic systems? Political philosophies as such hardly existed in the days when the Chandogya Upanishad came into being and these teachings came into being. That is to say, intellectual systems called political philosophy. The one and only way to do things. In other words, the perfect way, the perfect life, in every aspect of our being, physically, psychologically, aesthetically, spiritually, the one and only way to do things. And practically, how does one follow that? How does one express it in actual fact? The one and only way to do things, the supreme point in connection with this is not to do things in the way in which we attempt to do things. That is to say, we positively desire to do this, to do the other, and so forth. The one and only way to do things is to let things happen. This is the way of growth and flowering where the mind and the spirit are concerned. You let it happen, because the mind and the spirit are not my property. They are not something which I can control and direct. The mind is universal, altogether universal. This body, this living body, can more appropriately be called mine. And this body whilst alive, can move its limbs, can do this, that, and the other, and so forth, all within its limited, confined sphere. But the mind, no. If a person feels and lives according to my mind deciding this, that, and the other, and I go and do this, that, and the other, he is the slave of his desire. He is the slave of that which will bring dukkha. He is a perpetuator of dukkha, the ill state. It is the one who has ceased to do with the mind and the spirit on his own, is the one who has ceased to be a producer of ill, dukkha, the far from the infinite, the transcendent, clouded, spoiled by me. And then transcendence and the reality, whatever it is, functions through me unhindered, and I allow that to happen. And that is the one and the only way to do things in terms of religious living. Extremely difficult. But once you've really seen it, once that inner sensitivity has woken up to it, and it wakes up if you really care, which means that love in its transcendence at last has come into operation. And you're not going to spoil and destroy that which is eternally wonderful and beautiful and perfect. It's the one and the only way to do things. Let the bud open out. Don't start pulling the petals to make them grow. Let them all come to flower. This is the meaning of selflessness, isn't it? All right, let's go on. The next Deva Vidyam, which has been translated in the books as the knowledge of the gods, the science of the gods. I've already spoken about the gods, so I won't. We'll pass on. It is the knowledge of how to be in tune, in line with the constructive as well as the so-called destructive archetypal energies. That perhaps is is the sort of practical expression of the knowledge in the ordinary, I'm using the word knowledge in the ordinary sense, the knowledge of what the different gods, their names suggest. Their names stand for this, that, or the other. Zeus, Apollo, Athene, Indra, Varuna, Agni, they all stand for this, that, or the other. And a knowledge of them, you know that way. That's an intellectual knowledge. It means that as well as the other part of it, where you can let those energies function unhindered and cooperate with them by being aware, by being watchful, mindful. This mindfulness which we have so strongly emphasized in the Buddhist teaching, the attentiveness that Krishnamurti talks of so very strongly, makes you, this is the kindergarten stage. And then you become aware of those transcendent forces at play. And you're working with them. Something like this may have been, perhaps unintentionally, in Milton's mind when he wrote that line in Paradise Lost, it's the archangel Raphael who comes and takes Adam and Eve out, is it, or is it Gabriel? I forget. But he says, amongst other things, millions of spiritual creatures walk the earth unseen. Something like this may have been meant. Milton himself may have been unconscious, but I rather think he knew. There are so many things in Paradise Lost which indicate that he knew far more than those around him thought he knew. Tremendous amount of statements in Paradise Lost. Then there is Brahma Vidya, which is translated as sacred knowledge, the knowledge of Brahman. We need not talk about that for the moment, simply because any knowledge and all knowledge which is a force and energy to move us in the right direction towards the fulfillment of our human existence is divine knowledge, is the knowledge of Brahman. Then we have the Bhuta Vidya. Here some different translations get given. Knowledge of the elemental spirits, or knowledge bhuta, also means the form of the thing, the elements, that is to say the material elements, or rather let me say the factual elements, because where the mind is concerned there are no material elements, there are factual elements composing anything, the knowledge of all that. But I think that it would probably be useful also to bear in mind that the whole universal process is an anabolic-catabolic process, building up, and after anything has been built up, the form is transformed into something else, undergoes a transformation. But the transformation cannot take place unless that which was put together and produced this form, this particular sankhara, the sankhata, as the Buddha used to say, the put together, has been taken apart again and brought back to its primordial condition. And then there is fresh creation which goes on. So this Bhuta Vidya refers, I think, also to the taking apart process. The disruptive aspect, if one may so put it. But beware of using the words destruction, disruption, and so forth, because our minds are conditioned in such a way that analogically we associate destruction with annihilation. There is no annihilation. Annihilation cannot take place. is transformation. Then Kshatra Vidya. And the translation given is the science of weapons. The word Kshatra is associated with the word Kshatriya. The Kshatriya is a man who belonged to the Kshatriya caste, which is not only the warrior caste, not only a member of the, he was not only a member of the armed forces, but anybody who wielded power. Your judge in the court, your king, your town clerk, or anybody who wielded power and authority. He who dealt with authority or capital or power in any shape and form was of that Kshatriya group. So now, the Kshatra Vidya, in the spiritual sense, means the science of handling power, mental power, psychical power, and these transcendent energies which are beyond mental and psychical in the way we understand the words mental and psychical. This is the great thing. We rebel strongly against the word magic. But magic is a very simple, commonplace reality. Let me say this much then, that Kshatra Vidya was the knowledge also of the manipulation of psycho-mental forces and or cosmic energies. That is the Kshatra Vidya. Then we come to this Sarpa Vidya, the serpent science. The Sarpa Vidya, the serpent science. Now, of course, one has to use the word serpent, obviously, in its symbolic sense. The serpent is associated with the one who has knowledge, who has skill. And one interesting significance of the serpent is this. The serpent symbolizes the memory of the total past held in the subconscious. Someday we'll talk about that in much greater detail because it's quite important. And then there is the Devajana, the knowledge of serpents, as it is called. Here it is translated as the fine arts, which is a sort of a distant cousin to the meaning of Devajana, because Jana means the group of people, the serpent society, if you like. You see, Devajana. It simply meant the ones who knew. The knowing ones around you, you see, and how to cultivate your membership in that group was part of the knowledge that Narada had, the Devajana. And remember, Deva also means the gods, and it also means the shining ones in the world of things, of affairs. So now, this is something, this is a fragment, if you like, of all this knowledge, which is Vedic knowledge. And remember the Buddha's words, he who has gone to the end of the knowledge of the Vedas.